Let me introduce now our third reader for tonight. Lexington native Jan Eisenhower was executive director of the Carnegie Center since 1998. Prior to that, she had served as assistant director since the center opened in 1992. She has a BA and MA in English Literature from the University of Kentucky. She has taught writing classes at the University of Kentucky and at Transylvania University. At the Carnegie Center, Eisenhower teaches a weekly writing class that meets at the Lexington Senior Citizen Center. The Friday morning writing group has been meeting since 1994. She also co-teaches the nonfiction writing group and is facilitator of the Brown Bag Book Discussion Group. She has published articles on education in state and national journals. She has published creative nonfiction in Wind magazine, and in 2009, as a member of the Kaboom Writing Collective, received grants to support the publication of their anthology, When the Bow Breaks, which was printed using both traditional letterpress and offset methods. She contributed a short story, and she also did the typography for the book and hand-sewed over 50 copies. She is in the process of completing and shopping a novel, Old Beauties, partially set in a retirement community. At the beginning of September, Jan turned over the job of Carnegie Center director to longtime friend and colleague Neil Chapik. She will continue to teach part-time this fall, although she will be directing her energy towards writing, traveling, and enjoying her 6 grandchildren, all of them destined to be readers and writers. And let me personally say that, Jan, I will miss you at the Carnegie Center, but I very much look forward to reading your book. And now, Janine Blackwell, Dean of the Grad School, will want to say a few words. And after that, we'll hear from Jan.
Thank you, Katerina. As you all know, this is the 33rd annual Women Writers Conference, the longest continuous annual literary festival of women in the United States. And credit for that little word, continuous, belongs especially to the Carnegie Center. During the years in the 1990s when UK dropped the ball and its sponsorship of this conference for some years, the Carnegie Center stepped up to the plate. And by the Carnegie Center, we mean Jan Eisenhower. Jan, who is of course retiring now, kept the flame alive for this conference during its lean years. It was Jan who spearheaded the conference, becoming its own nonprofit corporation and having a separate board of directors. And that structure has continued to thrive after UK reinstated the funding for the conference in 2002. And for those of you all who've been around as long as I have, you thought, wasn't that just yesterday that UK went back into the business? It's almost 10 years ago. And I think that this reading this evening is so indicative of the traditions of this conference that Jane, who was at the beginning, is part of our reading repertoire this evening. Honor Ray, who was here in 2009, and I was actually the moderator for your panel, Honor Ray, when you were here in 2009. And now we're almost to 10 years back into UK funding. It was reinstated by President Lee Todd, and he's retiring now too. Under Jan's stewardship, the conference has been able to take place in this building, rent-free, for many, many of its 33 years. We are thrilled that we have a place like the Carnegie Center in this town to celebrate writing, writers, language learning, and the acquisition of skills for those who need to have a place, a locale, and a home in the center of the city. Tonight we are thrilled to finally feature Jan as one of our three readers to mark her transition from administrator to full-time author, and I sure hope I get to do that someday too. The Carnegie Center is planning a reception to mark Jan's service to the community on Thursday, November the 10th from 6 to 8 to establish the Jan Eisenhower Scholarship Fund, which will be used to subsidize those who would like to attend Carnegie Center classes or programs but are unable to pay the full amount. This scholarship honors Jan's longtime commitment to making the center a community resource affordable to all. We are deeply grateful that she kept us alive in the lean years. And so we are very, very proud and pleased to welcome the writer, the author, Jan Eisenhower.
Sure, I'll be able to read now because my eyes are gooey and I won't be able to see the page. I just have to say a few things before I read tonight. When we took over the running of the Women Writers Conference for a very brief time here at the Carnegie Center, actually it was like a child that we gave a foster home to. We tried really hard to make that a non-hierarchical organization, and so we didn't really think of ourselves as directors or chairs. We thought of ourselves as a group of women who cared very deeply about the conference and wanted to keep it alive. We found that the world doesn't want you to work that way. There was a lot of pressure to declare to name a director, to have a single person who signed the forms, and so I somehow ended up being the person who signed those forms, but I was sure not alone in that task. And so I get to honor Crystal Wilkinson, too. It was right there with us, meeting every single Monday night practically to keep that baby going. And Sue Bonner, Mary Carr, Laura Sutton, who else? I just have to say their names because Lynn Pruitt. I have to say their names because it was a collective effort, and we are so glad that we could be stewards of the conference and give it happily back to the university when it was ready to go. I'm also really humbled to be sharing the podium tonight with these two powerful women who have read before me, Jane and Honoré. So thanks so much. I feel a little bit daunted to follow the two of you, but I'll do my best. So after this, we're going to have a little Q&A, and I think one of Katerina's goals is to have us talk about processes and thoughts that writers have about their work, to do a little bit of reflection. So I'll tell you that I've been equivocating all day about what to read tonight, and in fact, in front of me in my folder, I have two pieces, because I thought it's like the birthing of a baby. You want to see the baby before you give it a name. And I wanted to see the audience, I think, before I made my final choice. And I think I'm going to go with what's been going through my mind. When I saw all the students come in, I decided I wanted to read a piece told from the point of view of a young person so that they could give me some feedback about it and let me know if the relationship seemed authentic to them. But I see that the lure of extra credit has led has diminished and led some of them away from the Carnegie Center. So those of you who remember what it was like to be young and in a relationship, can tell me what you think about the authenticity of this one. So here's a little bit of setup. This is a scene from midway through my novel. It's told from the point of view of a young woman named Shelley, who has recently graduated from college and has come home to stay temporarily with her parents in their basement. And she has brought her boyfriend with her temporarily to live in the parents' basement. His name is Myron. Shelley's mother, Sandy, is a classic sandwich generation, member of the sandwich generation, and Sandy is busy cleaning out her parents' home to put it on the market for sale. So you'll see Myron and Shelley and Sandy. And Sandy's best friend, Elaine. Elaine has a little bit of a sharp tongue. I like her a lot. She's that character that kind of prickles. So in some ways, it's tied into the other two reader, the works by the other two readers tonight, because it's about the knowledge that comes with the recognition of what we're losing. Myron and Shelley pulled up to the house just before 7. The garage door was still down, the house blank and dark. Although the sun was low in the sky, 5 or 6 cars idled on the fringe down Fields End Lane. "Sale opens at 7 sharp, no early birds," the newspaper ad had warned, but the shoppers had been lured by the address. They sat in cars with their windows rolled up, listening to talk radio and sipping coffee from Starbucks. "I'd kill for a tall latte," Shelley thought as Myron turned off the engine. She surveyed the line of cars. "Vultures," she muttered under her breath. Myron had refused to stop at the Starbucks located in the little upscale shopping plaza just at the mouth of the estates. "Think locally owned," he liked to remind her, and she agreed with him, of course. But the truth was that he took a disinterested attitude toward coffee, and that was the prevailing reason he refused to stop. Shelley had learned a lot about Myron in the last 6 weeks while he had been living in her parents' basement. A stressful 6 weeks, she would say. She laid her hand on Myron's arm as he reached for the door handle of the Subaru. "We can't get out of the car just yet." "Why not? This may be your last chance to grab some cool stuff." They had both missed the final preparations for the sale. Myron claimed a board meeting at the nonprofit where he had recently begun work, and it had been Shelley's turn to work late. She had tried to adjust her schedule, but the summer vacations of the boutique owners had engendered an attitude of complete inflexibility. "Because the second we step out of this car, the vultures will descend." Using her fingers as a comb, she raked her hair into a messy ponytail. "They don't know who we are. Besides, it's nice just to look at the house like this, while it's still ours and all." The brick ranch sat under the towering pin oaks. The newly washed front windows were illuminated by the brass lamps that her mother had polished in honor of her grandmother. When the sale ended, the remaining furniture would be sold at a local auction house. Shelley had crammed a cherry dresser in her bedroom and convinced her dad to let her store the rest of the bedroom furniture in the garage. She couldn't say that she needed it or that she had room for it, and it didn't fit at all, standing cheek to jowl next to a low oak chest that her parents had refinished when she was a baby. Someday, however, she might have a daughter. She would give her the low oak chest and keep the cherry one for herself, since her daughter would probably never know her great-grandmother. Maybe she could even figure out a way to recreate an updated version of the cascade of wallpaper rosebuds that her mother had slept beneath. The current likely candidate for father of her recently imagined daughter interrupted her thoughts. "I thought I might pick up a few of your grandfather's knives. Do you think your mother will expect me to pay?" Myron chuckled at the absurdity of the thought, his laugh newly acquired in the last 6 weeks to correspond with his newly acquired title, rankled Shelley. "Why not? The whole idea of the sale is to be able to pay for my mother's grandmother's long-term care. Are you some kind of individual nonprofit or something?" She had let her voice come out sounding meaner than she meant it to, but instead of softening, she flipped down the visor and began adjusting her ponytail in the tiny mirror. Her blue eyes stared back at her so coldly that she snapped the mirror shut. Myron turned to look at her. "You can't possibly be naive enough to think that the proceeds from a suburban garage sale will go far toward paying the cost of that VIP wing." When Shelley didn't reply, he kept on, "Because I'm assuming your grandmother is one well-off old lady, and when they sell this place, you and your whole family will be set. A couple of pieces of this leftover junk won't make a bit of difference to anyone in the whole scheme of things. I was just trying to do you guys a favor by helping you clear out some of that crap." The door on the minivan parked in front of them opened, and a large blonde woman in white knit shorts climbed out. Before Myron could say another word, Shelley opened the passenger door and climbed out of the car. She stood for a moment in the early morning light. Her chest pounded in anger and in grief at the sight before her. She watched as her mother, all alone, hoisted the doors to the double garage and admitted several dozen of Boone's most determined bargain hunters who, having no idea of the circumstances, began pawing the tables filled with the unwanted leftovers of her grandparents' lives. By the time Elaine Goodwin pulled up around 9:30, the pockets of both Sandy and Shelley were crammed full of dollar bills and change. Elaine handed Sandy a Starbucks cup and smiled at Shelley. "I should have realized you'd be here," she apologized. "I could have brought you a coffee, too." "No big deal. I'll just have a sip of Mom's." Shelley's face still felt tight, and she tried to laugh. Her mother was so darn prescient. If she hadn't been occupied making change, offering customers plastic grocery bags for their spoils, and answering questions, she would already have known that Shelley and Myron had had words. God, how she hated that phrase. Shelley eyed Elaine warily. Elaine had paused at a table loaded with dishes and glassware and had lifted a cobalt blue casserole. She groped in her pocket for her magnifiers and peered intently at the underside of the dish. A young woman in athletic clothes looked over her shoulder. "Oh, is that Bivy?" she asked, trying to glimpse the potter's imprint on the bottom. "I don't know," Elaine replied tersely, clutching the dish to her bosom as she moved away from the eager young woman. "I doubt it." Elaine was one of her mother's oldest friends, and she had the habit of saying whatever was on her mind. Shelley couldn't figure out what Elaine thought about Myron. Early on, she had come to his defense, letting her dad know that working for a nonprofit was a good decision for a recent college graduate. But in conversation with him, she took on an attitude of mild bemusement and managed to sound ironic whenever she asked about the progress of his programs. In her present state, Shelley knew she couldn't stand up to a grilling on the subject of Myron, who had pulled away from the curb as soon as he exited the car. Her mother had been too busy to notice his absence so far. Shelley moved toward a group of women who were sifting through a pile of her grandmother's Madeira tablecloths. One of the women, a cigarette dangling from the corner of her mouth, held up a pink linen luncheon cloth. "This here tablecloth's got a hole in it. Would you take half?" Shelley took the cloth out of her hands, mostly to save it from the woman's ash, and pretended to hold it up to the light for a better look. "Well, I don't know. It's real linen. There are napkins to match." She pointed to the stack of starched napkins, which still bore the crease from her mother's iron. "It ain't much good with that rip in it," the woman said, turning her attention to a table of knickknacks. "But it would be if I'd sold it to you half price," Shelley said under her breath, refolding the cloth along the crease lines, but taking care to put it back on the pile with the rip facing up, so no one would accuse her mother of trying to hide the flaw. She ran her hand over the cloth. Such a 40s thing to own. No wonder her mother had put it on the sale pile. Suddenly she remembered a birthday party. Age 5 had she been? Someone had come up with the idea of a dress-up. In the pictures, carefully fastened in her album, she and her friends sat around the dining room table. She wore a floppy fuchsia hat with a large organdy flower pinned to it. Her best friend Amanda wore an old-fashioned sunbonnet with a long calico dress. They were sipping pink lemonade from a white tea set that Sandy had borrowed for the occasion. A pink linen tablecloth cast a rosy hue over the picture, reflecting spots of color onto the girl's cheeks, which glowed with health and well-being. Shelley's hand stroked the folded cloth once again. Then she picked it up with its four matching napkins and disappeared with the pile into her grandparents' house. Thanks.
Now I will invite our readers to step to the mics, and we'll have a very brief Q&A, accent style.
For all of you back there, there's a lot of chairs freed up. If you want
to? Yes, a few chairs opened up. So please.
There's about 15 chairs. chairs.
So, everyone's mic is working, I hope.
Hello.
Who managed? I think that everything is fine. So, let's start with the first question. Could you please briefly share your impressions of this year's conference? Particularly, is there an example for something that you heard, saw, or learned that will carry that you will carry forward and will enrich your craft and worldview? And why don't we start with Jan?
When I heard Julie remind us all that it was the 33rd annual Kentucky, this will make me choke up, the 33rd annual Kentucky Women Writers Conference, I thought, what a remarkable thing and what a call to action to make sure that we have 33 more years. So, that, and then Janine repeated that tonight, and that really resonated with me. I have other things, too. I thought I'd weave them in as we went.
Jane, what do you think?
I was heartened and inspired by the spontaneity and enthusiasm that I heard from the filmmaker and the two poets who read on Friday, Linnell Edwards and Amy, unpronounceable by me. Can somebody say her name?
Julie can.
Nezuko Matata.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was Nezuko Matata.
She said it has the same rhythm as the song from The Lion King, Hakuna Matata.
Ah.
But I thought it was so, I mean, it just is inspiring to me to think about the future, not just of the conference, but of the writing that's developing now and happening with from young writers.
Thank you, Jane. Henri?
I see notes here, and I'm terrified. I didn't make any notes. I didn't get the email, so I'm just going to say exactly what's on my mind. This has been a life-altering reading for me tonight. Just to understand that, you know, understanding goes forward, passion for writing goes forward. A lot of people who come out of MFA programs, you know, sometimes, not always, but they give you the impression that after you hit, you know, 35, you know, your passion for writing just stops. And so I love the fact that I see women here of like all ages, you know, and it's something that you know, sort of stops my terror, because I had this thing that I was just going to wake up at age 50 and all my mojo was going to be gone. So I think I still got my mojo. And but as far as, you know, official, to Natalie Dew's craft talk was really, really superlative and gave me a lot of really good ideas. And so, you know, I mean, it was perky. She had a great sense of humor. I mean, you know, it was early. I think it was early in the morning. Yeah, I was like really, really tired. And I thought, oh, I'm just trying to be nice here. I'm going to show up to the craft talk. And I was like writing stuff down. So that was really, yeah.
Thank you, Honore. And when you said the lifelong passion for writing, that reminds me of something that Sally Bingham said. She was a guest on my show this Friday, and I asked her, what's your biggest success? And she said that the sustained passion for writing, that was her biggest success, and her first novel was published in 1961. So, and now the flip side of the first question. All of you teach creative writing, and there is a question I ask of all my guests who teach creative writing, and if there is one thing you would like your students to remember from your class, what is it? What would you like your students to really walk out from your class having learned? Why don't we continue with you, Honore?
Honestly?
Absolutely, and always.
Sometimes young folks think that intellect and good manners are opposed. They think that in order for you to be an intellectual, you have to be rude and you have to be cruel. And I'm from the Deep South. One of the things I love about Kentucky is it's not the Deep South, but it's the South, and I recognize. I ran into one of Crystal's cousins with her, and I swore he was somebody in my family. I recognize it. And so I think good manners really will take you very far, and you can be a kind person as well as an intellectual. That may sound silly, but that's what I hope that he says.
Jane, how about you?
In my poetry writing workshops, I think as far as I emphasize craft, you know, feeling that I can teach a person or even help a person toward in any real material way writing her his own poem. But what we can do is work on craft. And I tell them that it's like a math class, you know, and I'm asking you to do things in to practice things the way you would practice math, doing a certain set of problems. It's not that you're going to write a poem and I'm going to tell you whether the poem is good or bad. In my opinion, the byproduct of that for me is promoting the sense that a poem is a sensory, bodily, physical experience. It's not an intellectual construct which tells you how to think or how to feel, but it's a it's a bodily experience, and that's why poems are made out of images. They're the paint of poetry. They're the notes of poetry, images.
Thank you, and Jeff?
One of the great blessings of working in a community learning center like the Carnegie Center is that we get to perform a cheerleading function for our students and a less critical function, that we don't give grades, we don't try to pass judgment on whether or not people's work will be successful. And I found that ability to encourage to be very freeing and possibly also to be more useful to the students who come to class. I think it makes them more receptive to information about craft and other good things they can take away when the element of judgment is not there. I think we're doing... it's just possible to remind people that we're doing something wonderful for the audiences that we're writing for, and I think that's a real joy of teaching the classes here.
Thank you. So Lexington more and more has been, and more often has been addressed as the literary capital of Mid-America. I would like to hear everyone of you. What are your thoughts about Lexington's positioning on this title, and what can we do to achieve it and or sustain it? How about... Jen, I'll start with you.
What a lovely question. There was a lot of information this weekend about the changing nature of the world of publishing. It is not, it's not working the way it used to. And I was really struck by the presentation of Kim Dana Kupperman, who offered the opinion that the future of publishing, and I'm going to read this so I get it right, the future of publishing is going to be with the independent and small presses. rather than with the major publishing houses in New York that are being bought by conglomerate corporations. I thought that was really interesting. I think that plays nicely into the plans that we have to establish Lexington and Kentucky as the literary hub of Mid-America. She mentioned several fine, small, and independent presses already in existence in Kentucky. And so I think with that thought, coupled with technology and the ability to publish online, to blog, will decentralize, it will help decentralize the publishing industry. And by golly, we've claimed it, so so it's going to work.
All right.
Well, just keep bringing me back to Lexington.
There you go. And Jen, what's that?
I'm the last to know. I haven't heard that. I'm all for it. I think that Kentucky is truly, I think, a state of writers, and I think that that's largely because, for various reasons, including the kinds of farming and mining that has happened in Kentucky, that we've kept a closer connection and identification with land as ours than a lot of states have. So it's made us, I believe that that's part of what has made us a state of people who feel that we have a culture to write out of. We've got a lot of good publishing going on here now. I'm all for it. That's what
I just want everybody to know that Jane has done a considerable amount of thinking and writing about why Kentucky has such a rich literary history, and I can share her article with you if you're interested in knowing more about that. To those thoughts, I would like to remind everybody that there are 120 counties in Kentucky. That's 120 small stages for drama to play out on. For conflicts surrounding nepotism, how people earn their living, political disagreements. We've just got a whole lot of opportunity for conflict in this state, and that makes good story.
And I think all of us agree that quality writing is impossible without quality reading. And I was wondering if each one of you could recommend a book that you've read recently to the audience. Jane?
You want me to start?
Yeah.
I discovered in a bookstore in New York City, a small bookstore where the persons running the store selected books that they liked to sell. A series called The Art Of series from Gray Wolf Press. And I picked up that day James Longenbach's The Art of the Poetic Line, which it's the best thing that I've ever read on how line endings can work in poems, the usefulness of line endings, and he expresses the inexpressibles, or I'm not articulate enough to begin to express a lot of what he expresses, and I recommend that's very 120 pages, very small little book, The Art of the Poetic Line, James Longenbach.
Thank you.
So it doesn't have to be a craft book. Okay. I love craft books.
I wouldn't have named a craft book if this hadn't been, to my mind, a special one.
I'm actually going to, spend thousands of dollars a year on books. My mother gets really mad. I would say, if I had to recommend one book, All Aunt Hager's Children by Edward P. Jones. It is superlative, life-altering collection of short stories. He creates a world in every short story. Like, I'm a fiction writer as well, and I always say I want to be the love child of Edward P. Jones and Alice Munro.
Jen?
the Brown Bag group that I'm part of here at the Carnegie Center, who reads books by and about women, is in the middle of talking about A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it is a very interesting book to read and talk about if you're trying to write a discontinuous narrative from multiple points of view. She will give you hope that you can make it work. But I think she's very good at skewering how we're communicating with one another in the 21st century and how that may be shaping relationships and thought waves and brains. And it's just an interesting book and a very good read.
Thank you. I have two more questions. So the first one, it's kind of loaded, so I would say let's answer it, you know, honestly and quickly. Women writers, do we need distinction from male writers or special treatment or protection? Or what about our femaleness makes us special? And what are your thoughts? Who wants to start first?
I'm glad.
Go ahead.
I've often told this story, but I'll tell it again. When I went through college as an English major, I was assigned to read two books by women, two. One was Emma, and the other was Wuthering Heights. I went to graduate school, and we read a few short stories by Katherine Ann Porter, and we read a book by Eudora Welty. And that was it. There was no women of color on the syllabus. There were hardly any women. And so the Women Writers Conference, and I'm specifically thinking of the conference when we talk about whether or not women need special treatment, I think of the Women Writers Conference and the profound way in which it completed my education and rounded out my reading. Last night, Francine Prose talked about her essay, The Scent of a Woman's Ink. It was published 10 years ago in Harper's Magazine. It is online. You can read it. I read it this afternoon, and she talks about the problem with women not being able to get reviews or not winning prizes. And so just to check up after I read that article, I looked in today's New York Times Book Review. There were 14 major reviews of major books, and four of those books were by women. So those are my thoughts of the day. Yes, I do think we need to have a forum where women are celebrated for their significant accomplishments.
Thank you.
I guess I don't view it as special treatment. I just view it as equal treatment. I think that you have a conference that says Kentucky Women's Writers Conference, but what about the conference where it's all guys? They don't say it's men. They just say it's a conference. So I think that you do have to have women who are just mouthy about it and push. And I'm happy to do that work. I do feel like people try to put women on the defensive, the same way they try to put African Americans or other, you know, groups on the defensive about wanting equal, you know, treatment. And I think that what people don't really understand is if we women don't push, there's something that a scholarly friend of mine calls a canonical gesture. And so when you appear in the New York Times, that's a canonical gesture. And then that decides, like, you know, many of the books, the history books, I buy a lot of history, shows up in the New York Times first. Okay? Well, when I'm trying to find books by women, I have to go find those history books. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we also have to be, we have to practice what we preach. A lot of women don't buy books by other women. And so we have to be really, you know, pushy about saying, you know, look, if you're a female writer, you need to be reading, you know, other women, or at least buying their books, you know. So I just think it's equal treatment. And I think that we always feel like we're sort of, whenever we we ask for what's due us, that that's special. But nobody likes when somebody, you know, tells them you can't have the whole cake. And they're going to tell you, oh, that's special, blah, blah, blah. But you're like, you know, this is carrot cake. I want a piece.
Thank you. And Jane, sorry.
I think as long as women's experience of the world is in some ways, as it is, very different from most men's experience of the world, we definitely need women's writing and special attention to women's writing. We need attention to all writing and to all of our whole humanity, but it's really important not to lose sight of those differences in experience.
Thank you. And my final question tonight is the final question that I ask all my guests on Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture, and that is, what do you wish for yourselves and for our audience? And let's start with you, Jane.
I wish all of us big hearts, a wide and generous perception, and a way to have communion with each other.
I wish for us to be able to name humanity within ourselves and to have the courage to express that humanity.
I wish for all of us the energy to keep going, the ability to find something about our lives that makes something new, and to make room for a life of the mind, for serious thought, and for seriously considering the thoughts of others.
Thank you. Thank you all.